Our guest, Tom Hurley, is one of those people who gets to explore the edges for a living, discerning how to walk the joining places of inner and outer, chaos and order, individual and community. He has worked at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, Chaotic Initiatives, the Global Cafe, and now in leadership and consulting. And even more spectacular, he and his wife, Sarah, are now moving more deeply into understanding the soul. I had the great pleasure of meeting him at our Service Space annual meeting this summer, and I found his words deliberate, his listening deep, and his presence comfortable. I think you'll agree. So let's begin. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Jan. Hello, everyone.
So, Tom, what prompts a young man to find a degree program in futures research and wind up at the Institute for Noetic Sciences?
Lack of concern for how to make a living and lead a life that anyone else would recognize as leading to anything that, you know, we in the mainstream world we would consider security. I'm only partly joking, Jan. It struck me at one point when I was looking back on my life that one of the things that had characterized all of my choices throughout certainly my adult life has been that I've been guided by a different set of values, as someone said earlier during the storytelling. And have never imagined myself settling into a comfortable career. Have never been concerned about building up a big savings account for retirement or any of those more conventional kinds of things. At least they were conventional when I was growing up. And instead, I've always been interested and inspired by what's possible for us as human beings. I'm Irish on both sides of my lineage, and the Irish in me, the Celtic soul in me, is fascinated by the points where our ordinary life touches the other worlds, the larger worlds that we're part of. And so I've always been inspired to explore them, whether it was through futures research, which was really all about the transformation of our outer world, or work at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which in large part was about transformation of our inner worlds and the study of consciousness and human potential, or the many other things I've done where those two have come together.
Well, that sounds just delicious, I think, for many of us on the call. I think we can really resonate with that. You spent 17 years at ION, and for some of us, certainly myself included, that's a long time. What was it that kept you there, and what was your moment of transformation when you knew it was time to leave?
So for those who aren't familiar with, when you say ions, Jan, not everyone may know what you mean. So Jan is referring to 17 years I spent working with a nonprofit organization based in the San Francisco Bay Area called the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's an organization founded by one of the Apollo astronauts, Ed Mitchell, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon, which is dedicated to scientific exploration of consciousness and human potential and the exploration of new paradigms in science and society, particularly new worldviews, new values that that integrate our experience of the inner world with our experience of the outer world, so of science and spirituality and social transformation. So your question, Jan, was why did I stay there for 17 years? Well, at one level, I stayed there for 17 years because I never felt like looking for another job. But the deeper answer is that it was in the 80s and 90s when I was there, it was an absolutely extraordinary place to be. It was one of the few organizations in the world seriously inquiring into consciousness and human potential, which included the role of the mind and spirit in healing, psychic abilities, creativity, all kinds of different things. Meditation, I ran a meditation research program for 7 years, all kinds of different things. And at the same time was not only investigating those kinds of topics in a scientifically and intellectually rigorous way, but was actively working with a global network of people who were interested in how we co-evolve societies and institutions, business, healthcare, education, that are more respectful of our wholeness as human beings, more, and on the whole, more sustainable, just, and equitable than the world in which we find ourselves. And so I was in the middle of an unending stream of extraordinarily creative people with visionary ideas about transformation, and not only able to be involved in and support that work, but had ample opportunities in that context for the deeper kinds of personal experience that many of the folks who shared stories have touched on. And at some point, Jen, in terms of the second part of your question about my leaving, as wonderful a place as that was, there came a time after 17 years where I had been doing a lot of deep inner work and had been leading a strategic planning process for the Institute at the same time, looking at where the Institute needed to go. And there just came a day where I woke up and I realized in a kind of mini epiphany that the organization was going in one direction where it absolutely needed to go, and my heart and soul were beginning to go in a different direction. And, you know, in terms of moments of transformation in our lives, and by the way, I love the stories. I could spend the entire 90 minutes just listening to those stories. But in terms of pivotal moments of transformation in my life, saying yes to the knowing that was arising in me about where my soul was being called to go was incredibly important, and it was terrifying. Because I, as you said, I had been there 17 years. I had gone there when I was 26, so I had, in a sense, grown up in the context of the Institute. And everyone I knew through the Institute. In many ways, my entire identity was built in it and around it. And so to say yes to leaving was terrifying. It felt like stepping into a black hole. But I also knew that if I didn't, and by the way, I'm coming out of a nonprofit organization and thinking, you know, I have absolutely no marketable skills. So I have no idea what I'm going to do next, which was part of the terror. But saying yes and being willing to step into the not knowing was crucial, and of course launched me on the next stage of my own transformational journey, which obviously continues.
So part of that journey, I think, led you to your work with DHOC and the Chaotic Initiative. I love that word chaotic. You explained it to us at the retreat. Share with our listeners, if you will, what that means, and tell us about your work with the Chaotic Initiative and what happened there.
I'd be happy to, Jan. And before I do that, let me just make one comment about the being at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which you and I talked about earlier this week, which was one of the one of the really heartwarming and inspiring dimensions of being at Noetic Sciences was that we were a membership organization. And when I left the Institute, our membership was around 65,000 people, I think, which in the larger scheme of things is not a large number, but in the consciousness world at that time was a very large number. And what we continually would hear from people, whether they came to visit our office or came to a conference that we sponsored or just called us on the phone for a conversation, was they were so so happy to be in the company of like-minded and like-hearted people. I think many, again, in the 80s and 90s, many of us who were interested in spirituality, in consciousness, felt that there was very little opportunity around us in the world, in our workplaces, in our communities, etc., to find kindred spirits. That's less so today, but some of the people on the call may still experience that. And so to feel that there are places where you can gather and be in conversation with those who you resonate with at a deeper level is incredibly important. I think that's part of why these calls, these weekly calls, are so valuable. Now, I mention that because that experience continued into my time with the Chaotic Alliance. The word chaotic, as you said, was a word that Dee Hawk, who had been the founder of Visa, the credit card company, had made up by taking part of the word chaos and part of the word order and putting them together. And it was Dee's way of talking about organizations as living systems. The idea being that living systems generally, whether we're talking about human beings or animals or plants or organizations or ecosystems as a whole, evolve on the edge of chaos and order, where there's just enough order for the living system to hang together as a coherent entity, you know, for me to continue to be me, and yet enough chaos and change that I'm moved and called and to continue to change and evolve and innovate and adapt and so forth. So our work was with people in all sectors, corporations, nonprofits, government agencies, multi-stakeholder groups that were interested in how do we put these ideas about organizations as living systems into practice in our organizations, in our workplaces. And a lot of it was the essence of the chaotic way, if you will, is to design systems and practices that enable a group of people to remain connected and coordinated through shared purpose and shared principles while allowing for as much freedom and autonomy on the part of all of the people who are involved in that organization or community, or all of the parts of that organization or community, as possible. And that creative tension between freedom and belonging, or individuality and the collective, is a dynamic that is continuously being worked, and the edges of which are continually evolving. So we took those ideas into computer companies. We took it into community groups where people were working on all kinds of issues, climate change. We took it into the healthcare field, a wide variety of different arenas in which we were exploring those kinds of ideas.
Thanks. Can you, following up on that, I'm wondering if you might spend a little time talking about, because this also leads into your current work as a consultant for leadership and transformation. Can you give us a sense of what it is like when you're actually doing this work? And I'm looking at it from both edges here. Pragmatically, when you're working, are you working with everyone in the organization? Or are you working with just the leadership? What is the precipitating event that perhaps may call you in? And then on the other edge, can you explain your work with these people in more existential or spiritual terms?
So the answer to all of that is yes. and it's yes in the sense, Jan, that the work I do is multidimensional, and sometimes it's with individuals, sometimes it's with leadership teams, sometimes it's with entire organizations. And I'll do my best at touching on the existential part. But you know, in a way, Jen, it starts with me, in the sense that whatever the work is, it starts with me in the exact sense that some of the folks who shared stories at the beginning were talking about, which is it starts with my own clarity of intention, which is always to serve, and then coupled with that clarity of intention is the practice of obedience. Now, I mean obedience in a very particular way. If you look at the etymology of the word obedience, it comes from the Latin ob audire, which means to listen. And so obedience in its deepest sense is actually our listening to God is how I would put it, and to guidance from God. So I go into all of my work with the intention to be of service and to be guided in that work by God. I shared with you all at the Service Space Annual Gathering the prayer that I discovered on a wonderful little video called The Saint of 9/11, which is about Father Michael Judge, who was an Irish priest in New York City and who had a very colorful life. And those who are interested might want to seek that out. But he was guided daily by a prayer, which I'll share with the group, which is, Lord, take me where you want me to go. Let me meet who you want me to meet. Tell me what you want me to say, and keep me out of your way. And that's really my my prayer every day and every time I go into any interaction. So now to the gist of your question. With all of that as my touchstone and my orientation, I sometimes work with individual leaders as a coach or a trusted advisor. And there, Jan, I guess the other thing I should say is, and this will be no surprise given my history and what I've already shared about my interests and orientation on this call, I work with leaders and leadership teams and organizations that are interested in a purpose beyond profit. And more organizations today are recognizing that that business, as well as nonprofits, which have always been mission driven, even business has a responsibility to the world. That it's imperative for leaders in companies to articulate and to organize around. And so more and more leaders in the kinds of companies I work with, which range from very small local companies here in the Bay Area to some of the very largest global corporations in the world, more and more leaders are actively exploring what's their own sense of deeper personal purpose and how does that manifest in and through the work they do, and what's the higher purpose of their company, or what might that be in the world? How can they contribute in a positive way to creating a better world, a world that works for all, or as I sometimes say, a world that nourishes all life? And so, so again, with that as kind of the context and as a guiding orientation for the work I do, sometimes it's with individual leaders, helping them explore those kinds of questions around purpose and then how that purpose gets played out in their organization, what their what's required of them in the way of their own transformation to be able to lead in ways that are purposeful and inspire that deep sense of purpose in others. Sometimes the work is with leadership teams where we also explore those questions around purpose. And then what that means for the strategy of the company, the business model of the company, the culture of the company, et cetera. When it's with teams, almost all of the work has some part of it which is about how do we as a team need to transform the way we're working together, the way we're relating to one another, and the way we're leading. And the essence of the work I do there, or the common thread maybe that cuts across many different kinds of engagements, is the recognition that we're in a transition in the world in which many organizations are moving into hybrid models where there's a mix of the more traditional top-down command and control structure and leadership style with much more highly networked and collaborative structures and styles. And there obviously are some organizations that are on both ends of that spectrum, more one or more the other. But most organizations these days are struggling with how do we find the balance and the blend between those two styles in order to operate effectively. So I work with leadership teams around those kinds of questions, and then around the question of how do we need to shift our own way of working together to be more collaborative, to create transformative practices within our own team that will keep us on our own leading edge, our own learning edge. And then sometimes, Jan, to get to the other part of your question, that work then involves working with companies to engage more of the totality of people within the company. And this is where some of the work that I've done with the World Cafe, for example, comes into play. The World Cafe, for those on the call who are not familiar with it, is a conversational methodology which in terms of its mechanics, involves people, groups of four or five at tables, being in deep conversation with one another around a question that matters to them, and then in moving from round to round of conversation, people move from table to table, and so over a period of time, as you explore a series of questions together, people have the opportunity to be sitting and be in conversation with and be building relationships with a very diverse set of folks, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization of ideas, and out of that process, you're able to harness the collective intelligence or or tap into the collective wisdom of a group in a much more powerful way than can be done with most traditional meeting or conversational methodologies. So I'll use those kinds of approaches and others to facilitate large scale change in organizations. And the link between that and the chaotic work I was talking about is when I started doing the chaotic work, Jim, one of the things I realized after a year or two was that the most elegant organizational concepts or ideas in the world are absolutely useless if people can't put them into practice. And putting them into practice ultimately comes down to whether people as individuals are willing to be open and willing to change. And in relationship, it comes down to our ability to be in conversation with one another about the questions that truly matter and allow those conversations or through those conversations to co-create our way forward. And if we don't have those personal and collective capacities, then the transformation that many of us long for will never happen.
Mm. So you are touching on what is for me sort of the big hairy question that I have long grappled with, and I think many of us as well. And as you talk about the recognition for being willing to make some changes, why is the community that we call the workplace then so challenging to our souls? If we're all meeting there for a sense of purpose and a sharing of our gifts, why does it become so challenging? And can we as individuals do anything to bring our souls to the fore and become change agents? How does the transformation, or where does the transformation begin?
Everywhere, all the time. As the story that was related in the opening so powerfully said, the possibility for transformation is present to us in every moment. I love that story, so I thank you for whoever shared it. I'm going to sidestep the question about why our workplaces are the way they are, Jan. I think that there's a very complex set of answers to that question. But there's no doubt that many of us regularly find ourselves in contexts, in relationships, where it feels as if there's a disconnect or a mismatch between our own values, our own longing, our own desire for connection, for authenticity, for meaning, and what's possible, in those environments. And the workplace is maybe the especially because we all spend so much time there, is the place where we feel that the most. Even though I said I'm going to sidestep the why, I think one answer to the why is that many workplaces are at the heart of the structures that that are present in many workplaces are a set of assumptions about who we are as human beings and the best way to organize and the reasons for organizing that actually are counter to our own deepest spiritual knowing about who we are and the best way to relate to one another and why we're here. And so that other set of assumptions, which include ideas like human beings are naturally selfish, or human beings can't be trusted, and therefore the only way to get anything done is to treat people as machine parts and to keep a tight control on them in the service of whatever outcome is desired, generate systems and structures that then produce behaviors in us because we're part of those systems that don't call forth our best and don't support the ongoing kinds of transformation we're talking about on this call. So what do we do in the face of that? There are many things we can do. First and foremost, I think having some kind of practice for ourselves is absolutely essential. And that can take many, many forms, but some way continuously reconnect with our own deepest sense of who we are and of how we're called to live is vital. For me, that's a daily meditation and prayer practice, but it's also a practice of taking time for walks in nature in which I reconnect with myself and the world, for deep conversations with my wife or with friends, for reflective reading and journaling, etc. So there are many different kinds of practices that are possible. That's essential. And the reason that kind of personal practice, whatever form it takes, is essential is that without it, we have no way to stay rooted in the context of these systems that are organized on a different set of values. And so it's almost as if we're in the midst of a hurricane and we're getting caught up in the winds of the hurricane and are a victim to the system rather than being at the eye of the hurricane and having the opportunity to choose. So that's part of the answer. Another part of the answer is being conscious and intentional about how we relate to others in the workplace. And that's as simple and as hard as showing up in authentic ways. As Frank, I think, was saying in the storytelling, you know, at that point it's less about what you do and more about who you are. And are you able to show up as yourself with authenticity to simply be present, fully present to people? Are you able truly to listen, to be interested, to suspend your own judgments, and to listen and learn, and so forth and so on? Are we able to engage in conversations about the questions that truly matter? And do we have the courage to articulate those questions and invite others into them, or do we go silent in the midst of conversations that are mostly just chatter? And do we let the elephants in the room go unnamed and unchallenged? And then, you know, at another level, Jan, it's about how skillful and intelligent can we be in terms of developing change strategies, transformational change strategies, and enlisting others in those kinds of processes. And at that level, you know, some of the kinds of principles that Service Space puts into practice with the multitude of its activities around the world are very powerful principles for organizing transformational work in almost any domain. And in that regard, I'll share one more thought and then stop and see where you want to go. There, I mentioned the World Cafe a few minutes ago. There are 7 design principles for the World Cafe process, which are also, as I've learned through years of experience, extremely powerful design principles for evoking collective intelligence and facilitating co-creative change at any level in any system. The first one, and I'll just very quickly mention them, the first one is clarify the context, which in large part has to do with get clear on your purpose and intention, but also be smart about the context in which you're operating and what's possible within it and where the constraints are. Secondly, explore questions that matter. And the key idea there is, as my friend David Cooperrider, the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, says, we grow in the direction of the questions we ask. So if we're asking more and more powerful and transformative questions, that's the way in which we're going to grow, and we'll be inviting others to grow with us. The third is, let's see, what are they? Clarify the context, explore powerful questions. Create hospitable space. I think that's actually the second. The principle of creating hospitable space applies not just to the external world. How can we create hospitable spaces for conversation? But how do we create a hospitable space internally and in the space between us that allows for listening, for learning, for transformation? I won't run through all of these. There are four more which have to do with encouraging everybody's contribution, finding ways to link different ideas so that you have the emergence of genuinely new and innovative perspectives, harvesting collective discoveries, and there's one I'm blanking on at the moment. But those are very good design principles for transformation. And what I love about them is every single one has an inner dimension to it and an outer dimension to it. And as I said, I see, even though service space doesn't use those explicitly in its own organizing, I see those played out time after time after time in service spaces activities.
Yeah. Which is why we love it. Which is why we love it.
You warned me, Jan, as we were chatting for a couple of minutes before we went online, that sometimes the people you're interviewing tend to go off, and it's hard for you to reel them back in. So I hope I hope to the extent I've gone off, it's at least been on topic here.
It has taken me exactly where I was hoping you would go. So I'm okay with it.
Great.
And my cat has just joined us, so this could be a little challenging. So all of this is so very rich, and I sit here and I think to myself, as if this isn't enough, you and your wife Sarah are now engaged in a new project that I think you said holds a very special place in your hearts and has for a very long time, and it pertains to the soul's knowing. I'd love to hear more about this.
Thank you for asking, Jan. So I think I want to preface this by making a brief comment about the stories we heard at the beginning. I loved that opening. So, Amit, thank you for inviting the stories, and thanks all who shared them. Each one was incredibly illuminating. It made me realize, it started me thinking about transformative experiences in my own life, and it made me realize that there's a wide range of different kinds of experiences that I think we all have, and sometimes, you know, they are very powerful, almost altered state kinds of experiences, mystical types of experiences, and I was blessed to have some of those kinds of experiences in childhood, which profoundly shaped my path in life. And then there are epiphanies that we have, major epiphanies. And I've had a couple of those which have led to major turns in my path. I've already talked a little about the importance of transformational practice, and I think in many ways, as I think someone said, it's not the moment, the especially notable moments or single experiences that are most important, but it's the practices we engage in over time and kind of the slow transformation of our character that is most important. So how the practice of meditation and prayer, for example, over years has opened my heart and completely changed the way I relate to others. And then there are, you know, these moment-to-moment opportunities that we have always to awaken. And sometimes those can reorient us, even though it seems like the simplest thing in the world. It can reorient us and completely change how we move forward. I'll share a quick story on that and then come back to your question, Jan. Yeah. In terms of how I show up in my work, which was one of your earlier questions, one of the most powerful experiences I had was when I was with the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And I won't go into great detail about it, but I had been talking with a coworker, and the coworker had been making certain statements about the man who was leading Noetic Sciences at that time, and I was just nodding my head and not challenging those statements, even though I found them pretty dubious. And then the next day, or a couple of days later, I was meeting with this man, and somehow he had heard about this conversation, and he said, you know, you were in this conversation, and these statements were made, and I jumped in, and I quickly said, yes, and I didn't believe him, and I said that, which was a blatant lie, but I was doing what all of us try to do, which is cover our ass, right? And he looked at me without judgment and simply stated very simply, that's not true. You didn't challenge them. And in that instant, Jan, something shifted in me. And I realized the absolute importance of telling the truth to myself and others, and not colluding in all of the small lies, the little lies, you know, on which a lot of our society depends. And I mentioned this, and I prefaced my answer to your question with these comments about the different kinds of transformative experiences that we might have, because this work that you asked me about, the soul's knowing, is work that I've been evolving quietly, kind of below the radar, for 10 or 12 years now, and I got onto it because there was a period in my life 10, 12 years ago where I was reflecting deeply on everything I had done and what the common thread in it was, and I realized, and when I say everything I had done, I meant not just my work but also the way I lived, and the life choices generally I had made. And what I realized was that part of where what I have the most passion about is helping people uncover and live what I call the soul's knowing, which is our deepest knowing about who we are, what's true for us, what's right for us, what's healing for us, and how to live that in our lives and relationships and work. And so, as I said, I've been evolving this work under the radar for 10 or 12 years. It's filtered into my coaching and consulting and facilitation in many different ways. But now my wife, Sarah, and I are beginning to bring it out into the world. I'm doing some writing about it. We're offering workshops for people. We have some, you know, there's nothing especially new about this in one sense. It's at the heart of every spiritual tradition in the world. And yet we have some, you know, what others are telling us are some very good, powerful tools that enable people to connect with and work with this in a systematic way. And fundamentally what it's about and what I'm most passionate about these days is how do we live a life infused by guidance? How do we live a life in which in every moment throughout the day, you know, we are listening, we are open and obedient to that still small voice within, however we conceive that. And what does it take for us, again, to be obedient? What does it take for us to listen and respond when we're called? How do we have the courage to let go and surrender to what's awakening and moving in and through us, personally and collectively? Because I believe that, as someone said earlier, this is not about us as individuals. You know, the heart of my own practice these days is actually recognizing that it's not about I or me in the small sense. It's about all of us as the ever-evolving expression of divinity in the world, and how do we surrender to be part of that divine movement, moment to moment, day to day, and so again, whether it's through simply how we show up with intention and openness and a spirit of obedience in every moment, whether it's through our transformative practices that cultivate that kind of ability to be open and courageous and authentic, whether it's through how we engage with others in listening together and moving together in response to the prompting of spirit, these are all expressions of this work with the soul's knowing, and that's more and more what I hope will be the explicit frame for the work that I do.
It sounds...
Jan, do you mind if I just sort of jump in here,
please,
for a second?
Please do. I
would not definitely want this to continue, but I also want to make sure that we give our callers on the line a chance to ask Tom a question. I'm just going to open up the queue, and if you have a question, please push *6, and we'll kind of just jump in between Jan asking more questions. And again, if any of you have a call or a question, then you can ask *6. And it looks like we already have a few questions. So I'm going to go to
Ahmed, can I interrupt you for just a moment?
Sure.
Jan had said at the beginning when she and I were chatting that sometimes your guests, me in this case, were willing to go a little bit over, and I don't know if that's an option for anybody, but I can certainly continue beyond the half hour stopping point if anyone is interested.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's fantastic. And so I will go to our first call, our first question, and then we will turn it back to Jan.
Hello, Tom. This is Pallavi, and I'm deeply moved by everything you've shared with us today. And one of the, I find myself at the intersection of, you know, the space between surrender, listening to guidance, and grace. And, you know, it's a sacred space, and there is that space, and there's the other space of intention, where even if you're coming from a state of being, you know, I feel sometimes the ego comes into play, and I'm constantly grappling on this edge. And my experience tells me that surrender actually doesn't even have intention in it. So I was curious about, you know, your thoughts about this cusp of existence and what you could share with us about it.
Is it Olivia?
Pallavi.
I'm not sure. I'm grasping the core question. So can you restate that for me? So I understand about the ego coming into play. Is there a question crystallizing around that?
Well, the question is really, you know, on the one hand, you can come from a state of being and set an intention every moment of your life.
Yeah.
You know, and you can live your life that way.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, I use the word grace for it. When you truly surrender, you tap into a different kind of power that all of us human beings have. And, you know, serendipity happens, grace happens, things happen that we feel, I feel consciously we could not, outcomes we could not have imagined.
Yes.
So there's always, I find myself right now at a conflict between, do I set an intention, but, you know, that intention actually, what is the word, is at a much lower level than what is truly possible when I surrender.
Oh, I
or
see.
When surrender happens. I can't even say I will surrender. It
yeah.
won't happen if I... So how do you walk that line?
Yeah. That's a good question. So my own experience, let me just start there. My own experience has been that my practice has evolved from one in which earlier on it was more about setting intentions, and obviously, especially in a circle like this, you know, we all will be setting the intentions that we feel are the highest intentions we can set, you know, given wherever we are in our life journey. But you're right. There will usually be some ideas surrounding those intentions that may or may not limit what is possible if we're attached to those intentions. But my own journey has been earlier in the process. You know, we work with that process of intention. We continue refining our intentions. We start to recognize as we work in deeper and deeper and more subtle ways with intention and purpose, that we begin to recognize the different ways in which we continue to insert ourselves into the process. And as we recognize that, and as we continue our own personal journey, we get better and better at taking ourselves out of the process and being willing to simply put ourselves into the flow of grace, to use one of your words, and to surrender to a higher power, as you said. So I guess my counsel, if that is appropriate, would be don't worry about it too much. Just continue to work at your own edge in relation to that, and simply the fact that you're recognizing both of those dynamics and naming that question, as you continue to live into that question for yourself, your own guidance will reveal the path to you. But there's no doubt that a key move and a key capacity we all need to develop, however, you know, we enter into this process, is at those points where we have the choice to surrender to something greater that's moving in and through and among us, do we surrender or do we hold on? You know, do we shut down? Do we say that's enough for now, and retreat in some way for whatever reason? And I think the more and more we cultivate that capacity to surrender in those moments of choice, the more powerfully our own practice of intention and surrender will evolve.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you very much. This has been really wonderful, and I really appreciate all the work that effort has gone into it. Question is your soul's knowing the same as passion? I think it is, personally. And one other thing, I've done a lot of work over the past 25 years, many, 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 many interesting and sometimes very funny things. And when you get or what, I'm not going to say view, when I have gotten the sense of my passion, who and what I am, what this passion is a contribution to and for, it really makes me laugh because it is so simple. So much of the work that I have gone through, hard work, reading, meditations, fast, et cetera, when I finally got who I am and what my passion is, what it is that I could not give up in the face of anything, I could not give that up. I could not stop doing it and realize that's it. That is who and what I am. It really is so simple, and I just start to laugh because it is that simple. It's not sitting cross-legged. It's not any of that, although those things may be access to it, but it's really that simple. Your comments, please.
What's your
yes,
name?
Yes, you're laughing!
I'm laughing. What's your name?
Oh, Frank Boris.
Frank. Frank, thank you.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, well, how can we not laugh? You know, as you speak that, I can feel the truth of it in you, and it touches the same thing in me. One of the spiritual teachers from whom I find some inspiration these days is a teacher of non-duality named Francis Lucille. And he says that consciousness, which for him is another way of talking about God or vice versa, consciousness is happiness. You know, consciousness will manifest in us as happiness, as joy, naturally, when we're in touch with it and know ourselves as that. And so to your answer, the kind of passion that you're talking about, Frank, is absolutely an expression of what I would call the soul's knowing. And I love what you've shared about how simple it is when we've done all the hard work that carves away everything that keeps us from knowing that simplicity. Because you're absolutely right, I think ultimately it's very, very simple, and if we can rest in that and know that and love that and simply allow ourselves to be in the stream of that, then we are blessed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Michelle Ehlers again. I'm so enjoying the conversation and having access to Tom. That's wonderful. I sort of don't know which question to ask of the millions that I could. And I feel your areas of contribution are extremely wide. I'm not sure where to go, but I said earlier I've been working in the area of transformational global leadership since 2001, picking it up, not knowing what it was, but feeling a call to explore that. I have a deep interest in how humanity works with itself, how humanity recognizes itself as an organism and aligns itself and organizes itself or doesn't organize itself. And how that the external manifestation of that corresponds to the internal states that we have. And given your work in chaotic organizations and looking at leadership, I'm wondering what you see. Have you done any exploration or looking at leadership at the level of humanity as we're looking at planetary situations that seem to be created at the level of humanity, and we might want to organize ourselves with some kind of awareness to work together to do that. Have you worked at that level of organization? Have you thought about it? What do you have to say on that?
Michelle, first, clarify for me what you mean by leadership at the level of humanity. Can you give me an example of how you conceive that?
Well, that's the exploration, right? And over the years of exploring, what called me into that was a seeming awareness that we don't have a model that seems to work for that. I've grown up in many different cultures. I've lived in different cultures. I speak a number of different languages. I've learned, I've studied in different areas, and I've been exposed to many leadership models. lots of different ways of doing things, lots of different life perspectives, and they don't seem to coordinate with each other very well. And the models don't, you know, of leadership or how we should do things don't seem to cross cultural lines or apply when you get to the level of humanity.
Mm.
So I got into it looking for what that could be.
Mm.
And I haven't gotten any answers. I've gotten a lot of insight and certainly learned a huge amount, including, even though I started at the level of externals, learning that there's a huge need to go internal. That's been a part of what I've learned and developed that practice. But some of the sense I get is there's, well, really what I'm looking at is what is it going to take? What is called for to organize at the level of humanity to actually get to a space where we can have some kind of shared intention, not necessarily with every human being online, because certainly some people are less online or more, but some kind of shared intention at an organism level to deal with what there is that we could deal with or become more aware of what we're doing at that level of organism. And I'm getting the sense that it is not a, that it's unlikely to be a model where there's one person on top. It's much more likely to be a more chaotic kind of thing, a more group intelligence, but not necessarily the group intelligence that's at the level of 8 or 12 people, but a more deep intelligence. And I'm not sure we have it yet. I'm not sure we've found it yet, and that's sort of what I'm, that's the question.
I'm pretty sure we haven't.
Yeah. But that's what my life is given to, right? So I'm throwing it at you.
That's great, Michelle. Thank you. I think these are really important questions, Michelle. And I don't have the answer. When I was with the Institute of Noetic Sciences, we actually had a number of projects that related to this in different ways. So an example would be, for a number of years in the 1990s, we were helping convene and host a global network of people that were committed to what they called peace building for the 21st century. And the idea was bring together leaders from around the world, and these were not well-known public figures, but leaders who had influential positions in different organizations, in different countries, in different sectors, and so forth, to begin co-evolving both a shared vision of how what the world might look like if we were actually co-creating a world that nourishes all life, and then what were some of the pathways by which we could move from the world in which we find ourselves to that kind of a world. So there were very interesting dialogues, and some very interesting projects came out of it, and I would say a few things based on experiences like that and others, Michelle. One is, There were actually a couple people involved in the project who had what I would call an esoteric approach to the question you're asking. And in this case, what I mean by esoteric was they had a worldview of the subtle forces at work in the world and in humanity that are invisible to most of us most of the time. And so they were working through meditation and through consciousness and the inner world to work with an alignment with those subtle forces that are shaping what's happening on this planet at every level from the global on down. I think that kind of work is important. So I want to name that here. The other brief comments I would make is, I think that first I agree with you that a chaotic model, if there ever is going to be any form of let's say, global governance and coordination that is more conscious and that we would be comfortable with, we meaning the kinds of people on this call would be comfortable with, it is more likely to be a chaotic model than a control-oriented model. And that means that we are going to have to evolve ways in which we can have conversations at the global level about who we are as a species, how we want to be living on this planet in a way that, again, nourishes all life, not just the life of privileged few. And then what the implications are of that for all of our institutions and communities, economically, politically, socially, you know, right on down. And what's it mean for business, for education, and so forth. That's an incredibly complex process we're talking about, and it's going to, in my view, it will take a long time to evolve. Now, the unknown in that is to what extent crisis, like crises driven by climate change, which I personally happen to think is an extremely serious global issue, will bring us to the table in more conscious, collaborative ways to address some of the challenges that are going to be posed by those kinds of changes taking place in the world, by those kinds of trends. Anyway, it'll be a chaotic model. It's going to take time. We don't know the extent to which crisis will drive us toward more cooperation and collaboration and higher consciousness, or drive us into more fragmented, divisive ways of relating. So that's another part of the answer. And then beyond that, in the leadership work I do, I'm part of a global consulting company called Oxford Leadership Academy, whose purpose is to develop leaders who will transform business for good, with the double play on words of for good there. And right. And one of the things we always say about leadership is that leadership is about context and choice. And it's the first part of that I want to highlight in response to your question, because all of us, at whatever level we operate, in whatever sphere we operate, have the opportunity to be aware that our lives and our leadership, and here I mean leadership in all the ways we lead, not just in formal role-based positions of leadership, our lives and our leadership are always informed by the context in which we understand our lives and our leadership. And if we understand them in a global context and recognize that whatever we're doing is part of this globally evolving process and can potentially contribute to the evolution of more sustainable, just, equitable world, then that will inform the choices we make. And in that sense, I think we have the opportunity to bring this very lofty concept of transformational global leadership right down to whatever our particular circumstance is and make it real for ourselves. Now, having said that, it's very easy to have abstract ideas about what's happening in the world, and therefore to have a fuzzy concept of the global context for what we're doing. And so there's an imperative on all of us, I think, if we're called to this, to be learning more and more about what's actually taking place in the world, to be meeting and being in conversation with people from other regions, other countries, other cultures, so that we have a more and more grounded understanding of the incredible diversity in the world, and that both enriches our vision of what's possible at the level you're talking about, and makes us incredibly humble about our parts in it. So those are I don't have the answer. Those are just a few thoughts that were sparked by your question.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. And we got another question.
Hi, Tom. I guess my question was answered because my question was about responsibility connected to the last two calls, the simple authenticity that we have in ourselves and just facing what is presented to us by our soul's purpose in going through life and recognizing the small things that we do to maybe make a difference in our lives, other lives, and in the world in a small way. And what is our responsibility in the larger way, which was perhaps the second question of is it enough to just go through life and just do the best you can every moment and being present and trying to make a difference in someone's life or to make a difference in the earth's life by what you do? Is that enough, or do we have to have a higher purpose?
Yeah. And what is your name?
Noel.
Noel. Noel, thanks for the question. I think it's a really important one. Two things. One, an observation. The observation is that I think many of us entertain these questions of, is it the right thing, is it enough, et cetera. And for the most part, I think those questions can have two different sources in us. And one source is that they come out of our cultural conditioning. And so we're conditioned to think that we're not doing enough, or that we have a greater responsibility that we're somehow not fulfilling. And I would gently invite us to recognize those that conditioning when it shows up in us, and in whatever ways we can, and to whatever extent we can, simply bracket it and set it aside or let go of it, because I'm not sure that the culturally conditioned questions that drive that sense of responsibility are particularly useful in the kind of transformational process we're talking about. However, I also think that sometimes that sense of not enough is that can also be an expression of a deeper inner knowing on our part. It can be coming from our soul and telling us in a certain way, you're not fully aligned here with your deeper soul purpose or with your soul's knowing. And so distinguishing, the source of that "is it enough" question is important. And fundamentally, my answer with that as an observation, my answer to your question is continue to cultivate your own contact with your own guidance. Continue to develop a practice that enables you to differentiate authentic guidance from all the different voices that masquerade as guidance or as inner knowing or as the soul's knowing. And to the extent that we can do that, we can trust more and more the guidance we receive, and it will lead us to the life that we're meant to live, and that life will be the answer to, is it enough?
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we have one last question.
Tom, this is Pallavi again. As you were speaking, another question popped up for me, which is, what are your thoughts on identity through transformation? I'm currently, really speaking on the interpersonal context rather than a global collective context, but I found that the identity shifts and dissolves as we find our purpose, and once we do, I'm getting a sense that you have to be careful about not attaching your identity even to this new purpose. So I was curious about your thoughts on identity, however you choose to interpret it.
I agree with what you just said. I think I think that that voice in us called I naturally attaches itself to experiences and activities and relationships and so forth, and around that we build identities. I think it's a it's a natural process, and so I think the opportunity we have is again to through whatever practices we've embraced in our life to continue opening to the reality that the small I, which is usually what we mean by identity, is not the true I, the deeper, more eternal I, and to really allow the center of gravity of our lives to shift from the small I and all the identities it assumes to the deeper eternal I. And I think that's an ongoing process in our lives, and I think we need to be gentle and compassionate with ourselves when we notice ourselves slipping back into all of those identities that that the self likes to assume.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And it looks like we've got one more caller that snuck in. Tom, is that all right if we got one more question?
Yeah, absolutely, Amit.
Hi, my name is Alisa, and I live in Seattle. And I've been listening, and I found this really, really great and wonderful. Thank you. My question is that I do a lot of writing and soul searching, and I have come to a point where I know a lot of my passions, and as I've worked in the world, my opportunity in my work has shrunk because of the way business is going, and I've been looking for alternatives and not finding them, and it's been, I know that there's something out there, and I may have to do something like you, like letting go completely to look for a new alternative. That being said, it's hard to find those links and those opportunities. And I was wondering, when you left and you hit that emptiness, when you left the Noetic Institute, how you found those opportunities. I know that it's probably like a little jigsaw puzzle, a little piece in that, but what gave you the courage or the steps or the possibilities to move forward? It's a big question, sorry.
No, it's a great question. All of these questions have been big questions, but as you've seen, that hasn't deterred me from wading right in and responding.
No, that Irish, yeah. You've got the fight.
So I'll share a couple of thoughts, but I want to preface them by saying that I think it's a very individual process by which you know, the path is shown to us. So, having said that, I would distinguish. I would point toward three things. So there are innumerable books on the market, and I'm sure you've looked at some of them, that have all kinds of very practical suggestions for what you should do in this kind of situation. Build your network, you know, build your personal brand, yada, yada, yada.
Yada, yada.
Yeah, so there's all of that. And for some people, that really works. I have to say, I have never, that has never been my primary path. But I actually think there's some wisdom in some of that, particularly the parts of it that have to do with what we ordinarily call networking, which is really about, in a deeper sense, activating the web of relationships in which we exist, so that you kind of fine-tune the web to signal you when there are interesting and appropriate opportunities available. But you can already kind of see where I'm going with this, which is I think there's a deeper, let's call it a more consciousness-oriented approach, to some of those practices than is usually the way they're presented. So in that, but I think some of that is really useful, and you should be doing the parts of it that you feel aligned with, and even some of the parts that stretch you a little bit, because I think the stretch is important. Mm-hmm. Then there's the inner work associated with this. And in many ways, both when I left Noetic Sciences and when I transitioned out of my work with the Chaotic Alliance and moved into working on my own, the anchor for me, the touchstone, was a very, very consistent daily practice of meditation and prayer on the one hand, the essence of which was my saying to the universe, here I am, I'm available, show me what's next, coupled with journaling, and again, journaling works for me because I like to write, might be something else for you, but some kind of reflective practice which allows you to continue plumbing your own inner depths and surfacing and testing ideas as they emerge for you day to day, week to week, around what the path might be or what the next opportunity might be. Coupled with, and this in many ways I think was a really important part of my practice, particularly when I left the Chaotic Alliance and was asking what is my true work, I developed a practice every single day of no matter what I was doing or where I was, part of me would be asking the question, what in this moment, in this conversation, in this work, is related to my true work, and what is not?
Mm-hmm.
Over a period of months, that coupled with the journaling, coupled with the meditation and prayer, I think just created the conditions for grace to appear and manifest. I do think that grace is an ever-present part of our lives that we often don't recognize and don't fully appreciate, and that in many ways when we talk about practices, as I've done throughout this call, we're talking about creating the conditions for grace to manifest. So those would be some of the reflections based on my personal experience I would share with you.
Thank you. Actually, it makes a lot of sense to me, and I do a lot, but I don't interweave it with some of the others you said. And I would say your answer allows for something that most don't, which is becoming. And to just network and put yourself out as a brand, you've already shaped something that doesn't allow for what I want, and
yeah.
Your answer did. So thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really brilliant observation, and I think you're exactly right. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I think that's what people are looking for.
Yep, absolutely.
At least in this conversation. Thank
yep.
you.
Tom, I thank you doesn't even suffice to say all of this, just the beautiful wisdom that you've imparted on today's call. I wanted to just give you one quick opportunity to put in any sort of closing thoughts, and the same thing to you, Jen, and then we will close out the call.
Thank you, Amit. I've really loved the opportunity to be part of this conversation. Thanks all who asked questions. Thanks especially for the stories at the beginning. They were wonderful. And mostly, I just feel a tremendous gratitude and have always felt blessed by the opportunity to share this journey, this transformational journey of life and love and service with others. And I feel this morning as if I've I've been able to bathe in that stream with you all, and so thank you.
And on behalf of everyone, Tom, I'll echo Amit's comments. It's been just gorgeous. If conversation were a meal, this would be our typical Italian Thanksgiving dinner. So here's the question we ask all of our guests. What can we do to support you or your work?
Thank you for the question, or thank you for the intention out of which the spirit, the question comes. This is not meant as an avoidance of the question, Jan. What arises for me is truly that if each of you simply does the work and lives the life you're called to live by God, by your own guidance, that will be supporting my work.
Wonderful. Tom, thank you so much.